Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Hearst Ranch, grass-fed beef raised on California's Central Coast. Now available online through Larder Meat Company. Learn more at HearstRanch.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we're spotlighting the people, dishes, and ingredients decolonizing food. We're looking at our Thanksgiving plates and beyond to explore efforts to reclaim food sovereignty in Native American culture, the African diaspora, and Puerto Rico.
I believe that oyster dressing is like the consummate side dish for an amazing fried turkey.
What we're doing there is just working the land, and we're laughing, and we're creating a space for joy. And it's in that healing occurs for us.
Tune in to Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, a food writer and director of New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi, ramen, izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is also a mystery for many people, and I'll try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. My guest today is Joshua Schlachet, who is the assistant professor of Japanese history at the University of Arizona. Josh is a historian of early modern and modern Japan, specializing in a cultural history of food and nourishment in the 18th and 19th centuries, which was the era of powerful shoguns and the subsequent westernization. But the scope of his work is way beyond it sounds. His research includes global and comparative food studies and histories of science and health, which we can practically apply to a modern and often problematic lifestyle. By the way, Josh joined us on episode 98 as an instructor of the Washoku Iku program, which teaches elementary and middle school students in the U.S. about Japanese food and foodways through hands-on cooking and learning activities. So today, we'll discuss the flourishing Japanese food culture in 18th and 19th centuries, which also gave birth to our favorite Japanese foods, including sushi, the unique healthy diet philosophies back then, how we can apply them to our life, and much, much more. But before you start, Japan Eats is available on the Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. Now, let's start a conversation with Josh Schlachet. Hello, Josh. Welcome back.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure to be here. I'm glad we can have another conversation. And I owe you an additional thank you also for coming in earlier in the semester to speak with my class, which was such a lovely treat. So hopefully we'll get a chance to talk about that a little bit later as well.
Yeah, welcome. So yeah, we're going to discuss your classes too, but I got so lucky to be able to be a part of one of your classes, and I was so inspired by your students. So thank you so much.
Thank you again for that.
So first of all, where are you from and what did you eat when you grew up?
Yeah, so I mean, I actually Arizona is new to me. I was born and raised in New York, spent most of my life in New York City and nearby. So I was really fortunate enough to grow up, eating in a city and in a family with a diverse and a promiscuous palate, right? I ate a good deal of Japanese food as a kid, which I was very lucky to, or I should say at least what sort of passed for Japanese food in the 80s and 90s in the U.S. And I still remember some kind of fun and maybe by today's standards surprising examples of that. But, of course, I'm still a kid from a New York Jewish family, so I still love a good lox and whitefish spread at the holidays and every now and then. But that was kind of my my culinary upbringing, I guess.
Right. That sounds very New York. So I heard that you were in Japan on an exchange program while you were a PhD student. And mm-hmm. So when did you go there and how was the experience?
So I've been very, very lucky to be, you know, in and out of Japan pretty often, every couple of years at least for work and for school. And the trip that you're referring to was back in, 2015 when I was doing my graduate work at Columbia. I had the chance to spend a year based at Waseda University in Tokyo for my research. And that was just a really wonderful opportunity to be back and to spend maybe my first extended time in Tokyo itself, to dig deeper into the materials and libraries and get to interact with some wonderful people in the process. By the time I left Tokyo, I was really starting to feel like a second home, which was truly wonderful for me. I can't wait to get back. Unfortunately, those plans were scuttled by the coronavirus, but hopefully sometime soon. But before that, you know, I had spent a year in Kagoshima, in southern Kyushu, and maybe spent a bit too much time in between and other shorter trips, kind of eating my way across Japan during some other visits. So,
I didn't know that. So you were working, or you're a student, or what was the purpose of the stay in Kagoshima?
I was there in a Fulbright fellowship, so I was there also doing some sort of early research and cultural exchange, but getting a chance to be in a place that was very new and very unfamiliar to me, only familiar through books, with my interest in the sort of late Edo period. Obviously, Kagoshima Satsuma at the time was an important place to be towards the end of that period. So it was a great pleasure to get to spend some time there and to learn directly from the sources and from the history right in the area.
Right. And I'm sure you had a lot of potato shochu. That's the best of the best from the region.
Yes. I definitely developed a taste for it, I'll say.
Right.
hard to get here in Tucson. Still working on that part.
Okay. we can just talk about that on another episode. But so you are a historian of early modern and modern Japan and specializing in cultural history of food and nourishment in the 18th mm-hmm. and 19th century. So how did you get into Japanese culture in the first place?
I mean, it's such a great question, and I think I could have multiple answers for it. I mean, if you ask my mom, you know, she'll tell you it was when she took me to rake the rock garden at the sushi restaurant, you know, when I was four, right? So there's that very, very kind of deep history, maybe. But I think for me, the exposures to Japanese culture that were most kind of meaningful to me and that really got me started on this path really happened in college when I met a really incredible professor who works on the Edo period like I now do. Who inspired me to really think cross-culturally, to learn as much as I can about Japan and kind of be a voracious consumer of Japanese culture and history. And it really took off from there. So for me, really thinking and caring and immersing myself in Japan and teaching about it and sort of being a historically minded person, hopefully, more generally, really kind of go hand in hand through that experience. So from there, I just got more and more interested in Japanese culture and continued to learn, and I still continue to learn.
Right. Well, it's interesting that, you know, each guest we have has different reasons to get into Japanese culture. And it's funny that the 4 years old, that Japanese garden at the sushi restaurant.
Oh, I loved it. I mean, I've only been told about it, right? It's a faint memory from a long time ago for me, but my family remembers it very well.
Wow. Okay. I think all Japanese restaurants have a nice stone garden for attracting elders' attention.
Right. Get everyone started early, right?
Yeah. And so how did you get into Japanese food history, specifically in the Edo period? That was from 1603 to 1867, specifically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, maybe that one's a bit trickier for me. And I guess you'd think I'd have a better answer for this after all this time. And this is not the first time I've been asked this question. But I guess I've had a much longer interest in the history of cooking and the history of food culture and cooking itself you know, really from a young age, from, you know, watching the, you know, back then the recently launched Food Network and all of that, and being excited about the sort of culture and ceremony around food that had been something that was on my mind from early on. But maybe my time at the CIA, the Culinary Institute of America, you know, opened my eyes to what was possible with food, right? Partially with, you know, in terms of training that many of my peers went on to be chefs. I didn't. Just seeing kind of what's out there and what's available and how many different directions that food culture can take you in. So I must admit that, you know, back then the CIA was still, let's say, catching up to the trend of Japanese food in the U.S. So a lot of that individual learning I had to kind of seek out. You know, I think that kind of fascination combined with my experience there really helped it kind of grow and kind of nurtured it in that way. So I guess I was always fascinated by Japanese food culture and frankly, maybe a little bit, you know, frustrated by kind of how poor of a job I had up to that point done in sort of really grasping it. So by the time I got to study the Edo period, you know, in earnest in college, I felt very fortunate to have kind of found that outlet for many of these questions about Japanese food culture that had been on my mind in incipient form for a very long time.
Right. Well, I actually, to be honest, I didn't know that you went to CIA too. It's crazy.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. I didn't mean to.
Well, so that, how did it happen? Like, it's going to the CIA, it's practically it's going to Harvard of the culinary world. So when was it? That was before, after you graduated from university, or how did you?
Actually, it was before.
Oh.
That was before I went to college. So that was I guess I finished in 2003. So it was, right around the, you know, very early 2000s.
Wow. So you must have been really into food, including now, has been.
I went right in from high school at the time. And, you know, this was a time when, if you were interested in food, you know, the sort of celebrity chef thing had just sort of started. So there was a pretty strong appeal there. But if you're interested in food, you you know, you became a cook or a chef, right? And it was only just starting to be a possibility to get into, say, food writing, or even less so to get into kind of scholarship on food. So it's been a real pleasure for me to see how the field of possibilities expanded and transformed in front of me as I've been kind of going through it. So it's been a real, I count myself as very fortunate that those opportunities have opened up to such a degree, and that interest in the U.S. more broadly has diversified in terms of understanding and thinking about food culture and history.
Right. That's very impressive. So you wanted to be a chef. That was your initial attention when you signed up for the course at CIA?
For a brief moment, I think I realized very quickly that I'm pretty slow in the kitchen and would not make even a very good line cook, let alone a good chef. So that was sort of out the window from early on. But I did always want to take more of a, I wouldn't say academic, but more of a sort of interest in the history and the culture and see what direction that would take me. So at the time, that was where you went to pursue that. And it, you know, gave me a great start that I feel very lucky to have had.
Right. Oh, now this conversation is even more exciting to hear it. let's see. So let's talk about the food culture in Edo period. So Edo period was the first era in Japanese history when the general public widely enjoyed a peaceful life and the prosperity of commerce and culture, including food. That was almost the first time in the history, because Edo people really enjoyed that middle class and middle lower class in their life. So the capital of Japan during the Edo period was also called Edo, which is now Tokyo. So I heard that there are over a million people living in Edo. So what was the food culture like during the Edo period? And what did people eat in general?
Sure. I mean, so what you said is already, you know, incredibly important in terms of thinking about how food culture in the Edo period got to be the way that it was, right? This era of the Great Peace, as it's known, right, of 250 years of basically uninterrupted peace Not only extremely new in Japanese history, it's also extremely uncommon in world history. So that is, created a new set of opportunities. And of course, the kind of draw of these major urban centers, like Edo that you mentioned, what's now Tokyo, by the middle of the Edo period, had over a million people and was the largest city on Earth, right? Bigger than London, bigger than Paris, right? This was the kind of cultural center at the time. So this creates all kinds of opportunities for cultural transformation. But I will say that this question of just what people ate in the Edo period, which sounds very straightforward, is actually quite a complicated one. And it really depends on who we're talking about. If we're talking about ordinary people, then I think the answer is very different than if we're talking about, say, elite banqueters. I did want to share this quote by Michel Desserteau that I think sums this up so well. And of course, he's talking about France, but I think it equally applies to kind of commoner cuisine of the Edo period. He says that ordinary cuisine, he thinks of it as, quote, a zone of silence and shadow hidden within the indefinitely repeated detail of common existence. And I love this quote. I mean, for me, this is sort of a fancy way of saying that what most common people ate, especially at home, didn't even rise to the level of writing down, right? It was so ordinary, so natural for people to consume, and frankly, often repetitive. People would eat the sort of the same foods over and over again, that it makes it difficult to even get a full grasp on what normal people were eating at the time, right? But we do have some guesses, right? What were these things that were wrapped in silence and shadow, right? For most people, we're talking about essentially coarse grains, very little to no white rice in most diets, maybe a little bit of brown rice in rural villages. We're talking about more barley, millet, and other coarse grains mixed with a few vegetables, maybe a daikon greens, which was known, by the way, as one of the most versatile and most sort of good for you foods you could eat in the Edo period. But we're talking about kind of one pot cooking for the most part when we're talking about commoners, especially in rural areas, right? But at the same time, we're now starting to get a growing sense of sort of growing evidence that there may have been a good deal more variety of ingredients in the Edo diet than all this that I just said might suggest. And this is coming not only from people reading documents on village life from the Edo period, but even from people who are doing like DNA analysis of the gunk in teeth from skeletons from the Edo period and such, that's finding actually a much wider diversity of ingredients, potentially, of different kinds of vegetables in the diet, of different kinds of fish, usually river fish, unless you're in one of these major coastal cities. But we're getting this kind of push and pull between what's available, what most people are eating, and how wide that diet might have been. Right. But of course, all of this is in contrast to the kind of food of elite banquets, right? Diners in these urban centers, people of means, which could be extraordinarily extravagant, which, we actually know quite a lot about through very carefully recorded menus, right, of elite banquets, a very clear sense of exactly what dishes were involved in every tray that was put in front of every important person at major banquets in the Edo period. So those we know quite a bit about, and that starts to come a little bit closer to what we might think of as being resembling sort of kaiseki cuisine today, perhaps.
Right. Keep going.
I was going to say that at the same time, we have these kind of early forms of industry that are taking what are now sort of common flavors and bringing them into the mainstream diet, right? Soy sauce, sushi, tempura, right? None of these were widely available or even existed at all before the Edo period. So we do see a pretty major diversification of styles and the emergence of some really iconic foods and ingredients that kind of represent Japanese food more recently, right? So I think overall, we could say that for most average people, especially outside the cities, the diet might not have looked a whole lot like we might expect. There's not a lot of polished white rice. One pot meals were more common than, say, the sort of Ichijou Sansai model, the one soup and three side dishes model that's so common in a sort of standard Japanese meal now. So we see some differences, but also the development of very important and prominent aspects of what becomes sort of traditional Japanese food culture.
Right. There's so many layers. And like you said, you know, Edo was the major city, but during the Edo period, of course, Japan is the whole country. So outside Edo city, it could be just the farmers. They're just only eating, you know, like you said, brown rice and just a little bit of pickles and very poor diet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then on the other hand, the Edo people started to develop something kind of similar to like casual eateries and food carts, including, you know, Edomae sushi, which is what we call sushi, right? Because they made sushi with the fish just caught off Edo, which is Tokyo mm-hmm. Bay now. So, and I heard New Yorkers are very similar to Edo people. They're so impatient. You know, it's just a New York minute, there's an Edo minute. So they really mm-hmm. have to develop some quick food that was sushi. That was back then is made mm-hmm. At the cart and it was sold on the street. So yeah, that's like an interesting layers of one diet. I ask you a major question, and then you gave me multiple answers. And
sorry, maybe that was a little too much. But you said, I'm rambling a little bit. But like you said, the importance of the pace of life in the city of Edo, right? We have to think of this, just like you said, this sort of bustling New York-like atmosphere where the yatai, the food stall, becomes one of the major avenues for the development of food culture, right? And that's whether you're getting a cheap bite of soba, which is the most popular, or the emergence of sushi, right? This fish that's caught sort of in the Edo Bay right there in front of you and then, you know, prepared and sold as you're walking down the street and you just grab and go. There is that really strong connection between this kind of vibrancy of urban culture and the ways that eating is happening in Japan during the Edo period in these cities.
I wish I could just go on and have pieces of sushi just right for the cart and then keep walking in the street. Like, so cool.
Yeah, absolutely. They were big, though. They were at least double the size of a regular nigiri sushi now. So you'd eat them in multiple bites, and that's a big change. That kind of one small one-bite portion in front of you that we get now is something that developed later.
Wow. Okay. But I don't complain. The bigger, the better it comes to sushi.
Exactly. Yes.
So I also heard that over the course of, you know, a couple hundred years, they developed some interest in, you know, cooking. So I heard at the end of like 18th century, there's a cookbook boom and there existed over 200 cookbooks available mm-hmm. to the public. And wow, this is like a Food Network Edo version happened back then.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We have this kind of information revolution happening with this boom in print culture in the Edo period, where we have just an overload of books on everything you could imagine, right? But this kind of appetite for popular reading was especially strongly felt in books on food and on diet. So we have all kinds of cookbooks, some for excitement and popular culture and fantasy motives, others potentially to cook with, are coming out, right, that are giving people a real look at these kind of behind the scenes, usually hidden in fancy restaurants, images of how cooking worked and why they should be interested in it. We also have a huge boom in the books that I mostly spend my time reading about diet and health, and thinking about why you should eat certain foods over others and what that kind of means for your body more generally. So print is so important for circulating these ideas about what to eat, why you should be excited about it, and what it does to you.
Right. And this is kind of tangential, but back then, people really quite literate in Edo. I think there's a good mindset to educate people, and that was very important. It was prioritized, so people are able to read cookbooks, of course, and many other things. So that was a very interesting fact there's just not just a lot of people, but pretty well-educated people in Edo.
Absolutely, yeah. So we have a high literacy rate, in the cities especially, but really throughout Edo, Japan, that's allowing this information to circulate, far beyond where it might in other areas of the world around the same time. So we can see how that high literacy rate, that kind of education system or multiple education systems are contributing to the opportunity to learn new things. And people really embraced this sort of learning as entertainment model, certainly around food, but around a lot of other things too.
Right. Well, speaking of education, in your research, you discussed the influential work by Kaibara Ekiken, who addressed dietary health for the public in his book, Yojo-kun, that was written in 1713. And I'd imagine there were problems to be fixed, and that's why the book was written. So do you know what the problems were back then?
Sure. So first of all, I should say that Ekiken loved this kind of sparse rural diet that we were talking about before. He romanticized it. He loved it, as did a number of other people at the time, because the problem they were really concerned about was luxury, excess, and overconsumption in the cities. Right?
Sounds familiar.
Sure. Yes, exactly. This is very relatable. It's an extremely relatable story. So he's seeing kind of samurai shirking their responsibilities in favor of kind of luxurious eating and luxurious living. And he sees merchants who were meant at the time to be at the bottom of the kind of social hierarchy acting immorally by consuming more than they should, by flaunting their wealth through conspicuous consumption, by eating, things that were maybe not meant for them. And all of this becomes a major concern, both in terms of the sort of physical health of the individuals themselves, but also in terms of the kind of social health and thinking about the kind of fabric that holds society together and how people forgetting their place in favor of luxurious overconsumption could make that start to come apart, right? So for at least those who could afford it, we have new opportunities to eat maybe beyond one's social station. This comes from more money in the economy, more food in the economy. This is around the period just before Ekiken writes his book, published in 1713, when we start to see a switch from 2 meals a day to 3 meals a day. As being sort of common for people in the Edo period, particularly in the cities. So that is a pretty dramatic change. And he's seeing this consumption and then maybe looking back at this sparser rural diet that's much more maybe in line with his ideas of health and saying, maybe we should all be eating those kind of coarse grain, one pot barley and millet meals.
Interesting. So, yeah, it's like intermittent fasting already advocated by Kaibara Ekiken. Yeah, I heard that during Edo period, many people began to suffer from beriberi because they couldn't afford to eat polished rice before, because they're only eating, like coarse rice or brown rice. And as a result, their vitamin B1 intake dropped dramatically. So a lot of people suffered from beriberi. So maybe that's really the visible example of how people suffering back then physically. So, yeah.
Absolutely. This was not just... I'm sorry.
Just go ahead. I wanted to say that they were able to eat more food, like you said, 2 times to 3 times a day meal, but still majority of people had a lot of rice. That was the main source of nutrition and calories. So that's why they switched to polished rice. They really dramatically shift the nutrition in one meal. That's why they were really easy to develop beriberi. It does make sense to me.
Absolutely. It's not just moralism, right, on the part of these people who are writing and thinking about food culture. They're really observing people getting sick from their diets in real life. And they don't really, their explanation for why that's happening is a little different than the ones that arise in the 20th century. But certainly they're seeing, rice really coming into the cities as tax, basically, and being eaten by those who have this opportunity for luxury consumption, right? Polished rice. And when you polish it, you, of course, lose that vitamin B1, that thiamine that you need, that you would get from the brown rice or barley or other sources. So, of course, out in the countryside, where they're eating barley and a little bit of brown rice, they're not having a problem with that. But in the cities, we start to see the rise of beriberi, known at the time as the Edo affliction, because of that connection between luxury and the ability to eat new foods and what you lose in transforming the foods in that way and polishing the rice in particular.
Mm, right. So Kaimara Kiken, he was a doctor and he was a great author too. So that his famous book Yojo-kun. So mm-hmm. what's the essence? What's the core message of Yojo-kun, written by Kaibara Ikken?
Yeah. So I mean, there's a lot in that book, and this is kind of the beginning of what I write about. This is sort of the first chapter of my book in progress. The core message is actually very, very simple. It's moderation and it's circulation. Right. So, you know, eating too much food or eating the wrong foods in the wrong ways, you know, could really be the difference between life and death for him. Right. So this is both in terms of picking the right and wrong foods, which he has these very long sort of tabulated lists of what foods are good for certain conditions. Right. Whether you're old or young or infirmed or, you know, how that food will act on your body differently depending on what condition your body is already in. He has lists of what becomes a very popular term after him, known as kuyawase, what foods to eat or not eat in combination with each other that could create bad effects in the body. But all of this really boiled down to the idea of everything in moderation. So this would be like the most boring diet plan by today's standards, right? The exact thing that nobody wants to do is just eat everything in moderation. Don't eat too much. This is where the famous saying, by the way, of harahachibu or harahachibume, right? Eating until your stomach is 8/10 full, that's still popular today. This is where it comes from. He's the one who popularizes that idea. So moderation is extremely important for him. And of course, doing so, right, eating in this right way will, for him, allow your vital energy to circulate through your body unimpeded, right? So this circulation is very, very important as well. And that also involves your physical activity, getting up and walking around after you eat, et cetera, right? So he's saying basically that taking sustenance, you know, from food from the natural world in the right amounts, and allowing it to kind of act on your body in the most beneficial way is the core of the message. And then from there, it goes on into very specific and detailed advice about eat this, don't eat that.
Mm, right. And I also heard he was a doctor, but also a Confucian. And
yes.
So, and I found a quote from Yojo-kun. In essence, it's not the direct. I just translated. So. And it says, be calm, suppress your anger and desire. This desire includes, like, you know, anything from eating to sexual desire to anything to raise your emotion dramatically. And enjoy your life. Don't worry. And these are the keys to control your mind. Without controlling your mind, you cannot take care of your body. So, in other words, Kaibara Ikken taught how to prevent illness by being mindful. And in a modern life, we can learn so much from him.
I think that's exactly right. And preventative is probably the key word, not just in Yojo-kun, but in so many of other kinds of related texts from the Edo period, right? This idea that if you're already sick, it's too late, right? If you're seeking the advice of a doctor, if you're taking medicine, then you've already missed the opportunity to do well by your body. And it's really in, you know, eating properly, regulating yourself, which for him it includes more than just food, right? It's about sleep and movement and sexuality and a whole number of different sort of lifestyle activities, but very much food, I think, at the center of it. You know, using those properly, performing those properly as a way to prevent illness from ever happening is another one of those very important core messages. And a lot of what he says feels very relatable. Like you said, he'll say, you know, eat until you're not quite full yet, right? Don't eat until your stomach feels stuffed. Don't eat if you're feeling upset or emotional, right? Move around to help yourself digest after you've eaten. I mean, a lot of these are very common sense, you know, types of observations. Some of them even border on kind of what we would call public health now, right? Don't drink water that's, you know, dripping off of your roof or sitting in a stagnant pool, right? There are all kinds of ways that he's creating this sort of comprehensive system of how to eat and how to live. And he's only really one of the first people who lays that out, and then many others, you know, follow and create their own versions.
Mm, right. So it's simple and it's universal and it's applicable to this day. So that's Kaiba Ekiken's Yojoken. All right.
Yeah.
So
and if I can add.
Yeah. Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, if I can just add one more thing that I find so interesting about this text that my students really respond to also, is he has this some passages that feel maybe more Confucian than others. I don't know what the right way to put it is exactly, but among those passages is he has this this idea of the five considerations that is an important element of how he's discussing food, but in some ways a little bit of a move away from the central theme of moderation, but more towards creating a sense of awareness of the origins of your food and how lucky you are to have it, right? So he says, among other things, you know, be aware of the people who made the food for you and their lifestyles of you know, those who grew and created it, and be thankful to them for their for creating that opportunity for you. He says quite explicitly, even if you have no particular merit of your own, you may still have food in front of you by the virtue of the hard work of farmers. So thank them and think of them while you're eating it. Think of your family, and of course, in the time, think of your lord, your domain lord, who allowed you to have this food, right? But this idea of sort of really thinking about where your food comes from, how it gets to you, and how that relates to your own consumption, for him, really just trying to create a different sense of how you live with food and how you appreciate food.
Mm, interesting. I just heard that studies show that with the attitude of gratitude, your happiness level goes up dramatically. So, yeah, that really makes sense that what he was saying was so true.
Yeah, that was a particular sort of standout passage for me.
Right. Okay, so I'll remember that too. all right, so we'll take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll discuss what we can practically learn from the history of Japanese diet. So please stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Hearst Ranch. The Hearst family has raised cattle on California's Central Coast since 1865. Today, Hearst Ranch's signature product is their 100% grass-fed, completely hormone and antibiotic-free beef. The Hearst Ranches have always treated their animals with great care. Their cattle live a completely natural existence as foragers and grazers. Well-managed grazing fertilizes the land naturally, sustains a seasonal rhythm to the ranches, and produces a remarkable meat whose flavor is the authentic taste of the American West. Hearst Ranch beef is available seasonally, May through August, in select Whole Food markets throughout California, and all year round at their retail locations in San Simeon and Paso Robles. And now, HRN listeners in Arizona, Nevada, and California can get Hearst Ranch beef delivered right to their door through Larder Meat Company. Go to lardermeatco.com and shop the 100% grass-fed box to stock your freezer with Hearst Ranch beef. That's LARDER meatco.com. Learn more about the storied history, farming practices, and conservation efforts of Hearst Ranch at hearstranch.com.
This episode is supported by Nourish and Flourish. Nourish and Flourish features behind-the-scenes stories about artisans, producers, farmers, growers, and other makers in America, along with delicious and wholesome recipes. The latest issue of Nourish and Flourish is a special artisanal gift guide showcasing some of America's finest products, including everything from the farm and garden to eco-friendly home goods, kitchen and cooking essentials, bath and body, original art, blown glass, seasonal recipes, and so much more. Shop online to support local and buy local. Together, we can make a difference. Learn more at nourishandflourish.site.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, and my guest today is Joshua Schlachet, who is the Assistant Professor of Japanese History at the University of Arizona. And he's a historian of early modern and modern Japan, specializing in a cultural history of food and nourishment in the 18th and 19th centuries. So right after the Edo period, there was a dramatic change in the traditional Japanese diet in the new Meiji period. So what happened in the Meiji period and how did events affect the Japanese diet?
So this is such an important question and really one of the major turning points in the sort of foods that are eaten in Japan. So it's undeniably true, right, that the Meiji period brings about really dramatic changes in the Japanese diet. I do also want to say that one of the things that I try to argue in the book is that much of this transformation, especially in thinking about food and in circulating ideas of how to eat right and why to eat right, a lot of which happened through the popular print that we already talked about, is really starting to happen in the Edo period itself. And we can see happening back in that period first. So even if the diet itself is only undergoing sort of maybe modest changes, if you look at the entire population, we can see really dramatic points of change during the Edo period already, right? In sort of targeted pockets, whether it's urban centers or in the sort of circulation of information. So I find that to be really fascinating. But of course, things do change all over again in a big way in the Meiji period. There are a few different ways in which that happens, right? So first of all is the introduction of new Western and global foods. And the most iconic of these, of course, is beef, eaten at first in the form of hot pots or gyunabe, which is the kind of forerunner of what becomes stuff like sukiyaki and shabu-shabu and things like that. But it's also in early versions of korokke, tonkatsu, curry, foods that are extremely common in Japan now. So we start to see these really coming in with the kind of introduction of a more direct interaction with the globe, even though there was interaction with the globe happening in the Edo period too. So we see as the sort of arrival of foreign and particularly Western powers enters Japan in the sort of late 19th century, we see them bringing with them these major important foods that start to again get transformed and brought into Japanese food culture from there. Mm. We also have the lifting of sumptuary laws, which is very important, and the lifting of what had been sort of partial taboos, or some say bans against meat eating during the Edo period. So a sumptuary law basically is a law that regulates what you can and cannot do in a sort of cultural way with your own body. So these are restrictions that were very strong in the Edo period on what clothes you could wear, et cetera, right? How you sort of present physically, but very strong on what you could eat also. So we had laws dividing what specific ingredients were reserved for only the most elite people in society. We had very explicit and specific laws about how many different trays you could have in front of you at your banquet and how many dishes you could have on those trays. So that is one important sort of structuring factor in the Edo period that gets lifted in the Meiji period, and more foods essentially become available to more people, and access really changes quite dramatically. Right. Yeah. We also have the rise of modern nutritional sciences.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Well, it's just basically before the Meiji era, people didn't eat bread or milk, there's no cheese, or mm-hmm. and the beer came in. And also I heard the emperor has to show that it's okay to eat beef, because he was a symbolic mm-hmm. figure. And before that, people were skeptical, and some people got so upset that the emperor ate the beef. So they tried to attack the emperor, basically, in the imperial house. And like you said, it's not just food. You know, the samurais had to stop carrying a samurai sword, and samurais couldn't mm-hmm. keep their unique hairstyle because it looks like a little weird for the Western view. So there's a lot of things happened, but yeah, that was a dramatic. All right, so along with that, there is a term, shokuiku, which is a very important idea to understand the Japanese approach to food nowadays even. And it was coined by the doctor and pharmacist Ishizuka Sagen. So he was in the 19th century. And what was the meaning of shokuiku and what was the point of his argument?
Yeah, so this is such a fascinating story for me because we have this kind of blip in history of this term shokuiku that comes up in the late 19th century, in the 1890s in particular, and then kind of goes away for quite a long time. And then obviously, as many of us are familiar with, comes back in a big, big way just in the last, 10 or 20 years to indicate of, I think, a related but in some ways different idea to what Ishizuka Sagen had. So the actual quote that this comes from, which is a little bit cryptic, as you might see, is basically taiiku, chiiku, saiiku wa sunawachi shokuiku nari. So physical education, intellectual education, and moral education are all food education. And he says this, in his book on sort of how to eat and why, one of his several books on how to eat and why. And there's been a bit of a debate on sort of what exactly he means by this, right? One, I think, strong interpretation is that he's saying that all of these other aspects of your education, of your sort of upbringing as a person, particularly as a young person, are all dependent on or even potentially subservient to knowing and learning and thinking about food and eating right. Right. So Ishizuka himself is an interesting figure. He's a bit of an extremist, a bit of a kind of food determinist in his time. He believed that everything you needed to learn and know about yourself could be gained through eating right. And for him, he had a very specific definition of eating right. He was the founder and leading figure of a movement that's becomes known as serialism or kokushokushugi, where he's advocating for essentially nothing but whole grains, certain vegetables, etc. And he is in many ways pushing back against some of the things that we talked about just a minute ago with the introduction of Western diets, against beef, against bread, against milk, and trying to create a diet that was specific to Japanese people as a way to maybe counteract some of the changes that he saw as being a problem coming in during the earlier parts of the Meiji period. So he's a bit of a fringe figure in his time, but also a really fascinating figure. And his ideas, at least at his moment, really kind of lost, right? We can see how for a long time after that, bread and milk were extremely popular elements of not only rations, but also of school meals for kids, right? We can see the roots of that idea coming up in a bit of a different context and then becoming available to be kind of plucked out and reinvented in a really useful and positive way to create a new kind of message in the shokuiku that we think of today, even if it was slightly different than what he meant it.
Right, but like you said, the shokuiku word came back alive because of the government totally changed and emphasized on this idea of the food comes first and the food education comes first. So it's like it's a bad diet started to go everywhere in the Japanese diet, try to maintain the traditional idea of good diet because people started to have more diabetes and getting fat and all those things. So it's almost like the repeated history in modern Japan. So what happened during the Edo period and Meiji period, now we are aware, there's something wrong with the current diet. So let's just go back. And then there's the word shokuiku. And we started to talk more about harahachibume, like eat only 80%, that kind of thing. So it's a recurring reminder of good diet, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, if we if we believe in the sort of historian saying that that history doesn't repeat itself but it rhymes, then certainly this is a good example of that, right? How we can see this reinvention happening in a kind of cyclical way, and these changes and reactions to those changes that were so powerful back then taking on new powerful meaning today as well.
Mm, right. So the Japanese diet really dramatically changed since the Meiji era. And so what do you think is different now from the past? And what do you think about the modern Japanese diet? And maybe what we can do with that based on what we just discussed?
I mean, wow. So there's so much there, right? There's so much to talk about here because there's so much change that happens between the Meiji period and today. But maybe we'll fast forward a little bit to more, you know, to today's Japanese diet. And I guess some of the things that I think have changed are, you know, really looking, of course, at hyper-globalization, right? Mm-hmm. Which means that exchange and influence that had been happening to some degree all along happen much faster and in a much more sustained way than ever before, right? So you have not only international influences entering Japan, right? Particularly global brands, right? And transforming the Japanese diet in that way. But you have the reverse happening too, and Japanese food moving throughout the globe. And that's, of course, the sort of global Japanese food boom, where interest in Japanese flavors and also just the logistics to move Japanese ingredients all around the world become so much more seamless. Right. I mean, I when I arrived here in Tucson, I told my students how surprised I am to see you know, relatively okay Japanese food in a landlocked desert, basically, right? A place that is so just different in climate and atmosphere than Japan itself, let alone, you know, in a big urban center like New York or L.A. So that is a major change, too, is just how much global attention Japanese food is getting. And of course, this creates itself a concern and a rise in concern about authenticity and about heritage preservation also. That's something very new, right? Which, of course, culminates in 2013 with the UNESCO Washoku designation that I think many of us are familiar with. And what's so interesting to me is that in the early waves of the globalization of Japanese food in both directions, this question of authenticity isn't really on the table so much in the Meiji period, Taisho, even into the Showa period. And it's only recently, with the kind of rise of this hyper-globalized movement, I think, that we see a real interest in defining what exactly is authentically Japanese food, what counts, what doesn't count, and then you know, see, and then looking at the sort of food system through that lens. So to me, that's a big change as well that's happened quite recently.
Right. Well, you know, at the University of Arizona, you teach a course, The Culture of Food and Health in Japan. So so based on what you just said, you know, there are students, American students, taking your course, which sounds fascinating. And so what do you teach to your students, and what's the students' motivation to sign up for your classes?
Yeah, I mean, another really interesting question. I guess for me, you know, I think there's so much we can learn from the history of the Japanese diet, but also a few things that maybe we can't, right? You know, first, I think for people who are trying to kind of look to the past for a sort of ready-made ideal diet to practice right now, I think they may be a little bit disappointed. And many have tried this, right? I think you're also in for a surprise about just how new or, you know, many of the dishes that we consider traditional Japanese cuisine really are. And, you know, thinking about when they enter, how they enter, and what the circumstances are, for me, is the most fascinating part. The point I really want to make about this is that new and old and traditional and not traditional, for me, are not even the most useful categories for understanding what is or isn't Japanese food culture. You know, if you're asking yourself whether this dish that's in front of you is or isn't authentic, I think the answer is that really they all are, as long as you ask not just authentic to where, but also authentic to when. And one of the things I try to teach my students is to really pay attention to that how time works, right? And how Japanese food transforms and how all of that, you know, creates a really rich and deep sort of culture of food that resides across time periods, right? So this kind of richness and diversity of Japanese food culture, including diversity across time, to me really shows us this kind of inexhaustible source of inspiration, of excitement, of creative change that I think Japanese cuisine really represents. So that's the first thing I really try to instill in my students.
Right. I really want to run through your syllabus, and I was really curious because you just go through, you have a comparative view, compare Japanese and French cuisine. And I mean, I spoke to your students, but they're really interested in healthy food. I think that's their generation, right? Your students' mm-hmm. generation.
I really think so. So I tend to have a couple of different sort of groups of students in the course, right? Sort of the largest group is usually students with an interest in Japanese contemporary culture, usually through their exposure to pop culture, anime, etc. And then another group of students who are maybe either just majors in food studies or nutritional sciences, or who just want to kind of get a different cultural outlook on how to eat and how to live. This is really interesting and different for me. I think even just from, you know, my own generation when I was, you know, their age, not to date myself too much here, I think that question of eating and living a healthy lifestyle as a strong motivating factor to take a college course might not have been there in quite as broad a way. And I know that's painting with a broad brush, but that's my impression, that we really do have a change in the interest among young people who are really, really want to know how their diets and lifestyles kind of affect them in a broader way and how to, you know, treat themselves and their bodies as well as they possibly can. And not only just in a sort of scientific perspective, but in a cultural context, too. And to look abroad and look to examples from other cultures that might be less familiar to their everyday experiences and try to see what lessons they can draw from that. So trying to facilitate that exploration is something that's really important to me.
Right. They are probably the first generation who has to think of the risk they're exposed to in terms of ecology and diet. And it's like survival, right? Unless you somewhat switch to plant-based diet, your future could be at risk physically. Yeah. So that's a different mindset. And I'm really interested in those, you know, the new generation's mindset. And it's really, it's a sort of celebration. They're really broad-minded, global-minded, and, you know, they have a serious concerns about the future. So I'm very hopeful what how they're going to carry this direction to somewhere else than in the past. So anyway, so what are you working on right now besides teaching?
Wow. Well, first of all, I should say I'm very hopeful for this generation, too. And it's a pleasure to work with them and to see just how they're, like you said, their experiences and maybe the necessity of asking these kinds of questions right now is driving this this new set of interests, and I really appreciate that, and I appreciate them. In terms of my own work, I'm really polishing up the book manuscript at this point, trying to get that finished, and the book is basically all about concepts and knowledge and ideas of dietary health in the Edo period and how they start to circulate to new people. So a lot of it we've talked about already today. So I'm finishing up the book manuscript and searching for, you know, publishing opportunities for all of that. And I'm always, of course, seeking collaborators, both on food history and on Japanese culture more generally. So please feel free to get in touch. I would love to talk with any of you who are listening.
Sure.
So do you know when to think about these questions?
Yeah. And do you know when the book is coming out?
Not yet. So I'm still working on that part right now, but I'm nearing, I believe, completion from my end. So then we're I'll look for a chance to publish it from there. And then hopefully it'll be out as soon as possible. Fingers crossed.
Okay. So when it comes out, please come back. And I really want to know more about in depth about what you're researching on, because this is very important. So, all right.
I would love to. I could talk about this all day.
I know. So, well, good luck with the book. And where can we find your updates online or social media?
Sure. So I must admit, I keep a rather low profile on social media, but that does not mean that I don't want to hear from you. I would love to talk with you or interact with anybody who's interested. So you can always reach me by email and through my webpage, the University of Arizona, in the East Asian Studies department. So I can give my email address now, or is it better to write it out? So it's just J Schlackett, JSCHLACHET at email.arizona.edu. And I would love to hear from you. Thank you so much.
All right, great. So thank you so much for joining us today, Josh. And yeah, it's amazing. So I learned so much from you today. So I'll try to be healthier based on.
So will I, please. I have a long way to go as well.
Right. So, listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japanneeds@heritageradionetwork.org or at kikuatema.com. Japan Needs is a weekly program and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Our engineer is Naman Wang, and thank you for listening. I will see you next week.
Japan Needs is powered by Simplecast. Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network, Food Radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a non-profit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thank you for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lam, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.